Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Welcome back to Heritage Radio Network on Tour. I'm Kat Johnson. We are broadcasting today from the Charleston Wine and Food Festival. We're in the Culinary Village. It's our fifth year doing this. Can you believe it? I am joined once again by Hannah Forden and Eli Sussman, my esteemed HRN colleagues. Eli is on the social media, so you can follow our stories at Heritage_Radio and at the Sussmans. Check it out. So we just had a conversation with Johnny Caldwell and Tanika Reeves, also known as the Cocktail Bandits, and they mentioned our next guests a couple of times, who are their good friends and our good friends. We're thrilled to have them back joining us. We have Matt and Ted Lee, aka the Lee Brothers. Welcome, guys.
Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to have you back in Charleston.
We're happy to be here.
In your lounge here.
We're feeling very loungy today.
It's
we got a couch.
Awesome.
We got some chairs.
Cozy. If only we had last year, Matthew Rayford took full advantage of the couch by laying across it for the entirety of his interview and rested the microphone on his chest, which is by far the most relaxed anyone has ever been.
Has ever been HRN. At HRN.
We got to bring it back.
Feel free, stretch out, get comfortable. So the first time that I met you guys, it was at Fire, Flower, and Fork, which is a couple years ago in Richmond.
Oh, yeah.
And at that point, your latest book, it's still your latest book, right? Hotbox?
Yes.
It had not yet come out.
Correct.
But you kind of gave me some scoop on what the book was about.
That's right. You were our first interview about that material.
Thank you. I'm honored.
Yeah. We slipped up and we divulged some material
that
probably the publisher didn't want.
Yeah. The publisher was sort of like, yeah, that was okay, but we'd prefer not.
Oh, well, I feel like I just really did a great job.
It is a true scoop.
Yeah, you got the scoop.
Awesome. So it has since come out.
Correct.
I read it very quickly. I devoured it. It was so fascinating. I think a lot of people kind of compared it to Kitchen Confidential, but for catering. What has been the response of the book coming out since you guys have really kind of toured it and it's been out for a while now?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. You know, we're... We have no read on like the reception except what we hear from people who we meet, you know? And I think the most gratifying ingredient of it is that the industry, the catering industry, which, you know, is a huge industry. It kind of lives a little bit in the shadows. That was kind of part of what the book contended with. But mostly they just feel seen. And we're cringing a little bit on publication because we did tell a lot of secrets and a lot of truths about the industry that are sometimes uncomfortable, about the labor, about the conditions backstage, behind the curtain, in the kitchen, whatever. We were a little bit worried that some people would feel, you know, exposed, but it's been kind of the opposite. It's that simply telling anything about catering into, you know, a void of knowledge about how it works has been seen as a benefit, you know, to the industry, to the people who work in it. And even so much that some caterers are using the book and giving it to their clients to help explain why they charge so much.
Right. why they charge so much.
Or why the conditions
they may not be so accepting of, you know, the client saying, oh, I want you to do this, which is completely outside your comfort zone. You know, there are a lot of takeaways from the book, I think, that are sort of truths about the business of catering. One of them being like, if a caterer has a 20-year reputation, there's a reason for it. So let them do what they do well, right? And don't say like, oh, you know, I want my entree to be a tribute to the trip I took to El Bulli in 1994. And no.
I don't even really do Spanish food.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Come on.
But there are clients who do that because there are caterers who've established themselves as the geniuses of customization. It's like, what story do you want to tell?
We can do
tell
it.
That story in a 7-course meal, you know.
The
in,
sales
in a
team's
tenth.
Trained to say yes to
but
any
it will
crazy
you,
request.
But it will cost
and,
you.
Yeah,
that's
and it
why.
Costs you. And that's, I mean, catering is a luxury product. It's sort of like.
And Eli, you've done catering, yeah?
Yeah, lots.
Oh my gosh.
And what you illuminated as well is all the levels and styles of catering that also can almost mimic the levels and styles of restaurants. Like, there are no two chefs that are alike, and the catering companies, the skill sets that those people bring are unreal. To be able to make small bites for 1,000 people takes a certain type of crazy, right?
Yes.
And
yeah,
it takes
for
a,
sure.
It takes an unreasonable skill set to be able to prep out 1,000 pounds of food in yeah. a way that maybe someone on the line in a restaurant who's going to do 70 fine dining covers that night, maybe they can't do that, right?
True.
So I wonder, like, what were some of the things that surprised you two the most as you were digging in and you heard these stories from these caterers that you guys being in the industry for so long, what blew your mind?
Well, I think the first thing was when we first met our first catering chefs, Juan and Jorge Soto and Patrick Phelan, was simply how compromised the conditions are in the kitchen. And I'm not talking about the prep kitchen. The prep kitchen's great. But once you get on site and you actually have to finish the food and like bring it in for a landing, and you know, 1400 portions, if it's, like a high end event where there's an expectation of doneness on that, you know, beef fillet or whatever, like you're just landing all these things simultaneously, without the benefit of running water, you know,
HVAC
gas. You know, yeah. they're cooking over Sterno. That was the first insight was like, oh my God, they're cooking over Sterno.
But also like
in New York City, at the highest levels, you know, 3,000 a plate dinner, you know,
those hot boxes.
Hillary Clinton's
hot.
Out there, like
real hot,
you know. But they're cooking over alcohol, you know, jellied alcohol.
But
that's
also,
a weird handicap to have yeah. in the kitchen.
Also, what sort of redounded to the characters of the kinds of people who excel in these environments is that the anonymity, like. Being accustomed to, you know, that restaurant culture, festival culture where, you know, we're excited because Chef So-and-so is here, you know, and they've brought their team and they've all got their jackets.
And there's
their
a placard
names
with their name on it, you know. They're being like, celebrated and
catering chefs never are seen or celebrated or anything. And they're good with that. Right, they it doesn't make a difference to them whether someone comes back in the tent, the client comes back in the tent and says, great job, guys. They don't. That's not what it's in it for them. They look at those 1,000 canapes and they're like stoked. And, you know, that takes a certain mettle, you know, like
there's
a
also,
certain, you know, toughness.
Yeah, because you wrote a lot about, you worked in like the prep kitchen
yes.
in New York for a while
yeah.
and it drove you crazy, which I thought was
yeah.
interesting.
Yeah, because.
But there's two different kinds of chefs, right? There's like prep kitchen and then
there's
event.
Prep and fiesta.
There's prep
yeah.
and fiesta.
Yeah.
And, you know, for prep chefs, they really have to be good with like total dissociation between task and result, right? Like, you know, the production chef is telling you to peel 40 pounds of carrots. You don't know where those carrots are going. You don't know. There's no story. You know, there's nothing. You're just peeling the carrots and that's what you're doing. And you're doing an awesome job of it. And I just had a hard time.
Ted needs closure. That's his problem.
Like, I want the narrative. It's like, wait, like, who's going to, is someone going to be, like, blanching these? Like, what's going to go? And they're like, no, that's not your problem. Like, that's someone else's problem. It's like,
I
just get back to
the carrots.
I want to
know what the fate of these carrots are.
No, I know, but that
was
like.
As a home cook, you have this privilege, which is that you shopped, you chopped, and, you know, you fed it to your family, and you get their gratification
or
you know. Disrespect or whatever, but like at least you have closure, and like, that in itself is a nice circuit to make. And but what if you only got one? You know, what if you're only shopping? What if you're only chopping? You know,
it made me realize how being a home cook is like such an extreme privilege on every level. Yeah.
And then the other thing that I really enjoyed about the book was that. You were really like undercover. You guys were working these events, not really as like the Lee brothers, but as just part of the crew. And sometimes it worked, and sometimes people were like, hey, I know you guys.
Do you have secret names? Like,
No.
I mean,
the cool thing, when we went into it, it was like cloak and dagger. Like, should we, you know, wear contact lenses or something? And it was, they don't give a damn because in catering, it's so mercenary, like, especially Fiesta, but even in the prep kitchen, most people are not full employees, and so people fade in and out of a certain firm by day of week, by, you know, season of their life, whatever. Like, there's no permanence in it, and so it was totally natural that two unfamiliar faces would show up,
you know,
and there's not a lot of rapture for the, like, you know, magazine media driven, you know, restaurants.
They're like, thank God, another body. Like, get over here and start peeling this off.
It's like, we were like warm bodies, and the only thing that counted was, could we use a knife, you know?
Right. And
for the most part,
it was even beyond that. It was like, are you high or drunk? Do you have two hands? All right, get on the bus. We're going to the Hamptons. You know, it was literally like that on some level, because there's so much demand for labor.
You mentioned the Hamptons. Can you actually talk about, like, a little bit the world of high-end catering, which,
well, that was
not everyone gets privy to that thing, but, like, it is, people spend, what, $500,000 on food at a party, more?
At a party for 120 adults. Like, that's the crazy thing. And one of the first parties I worked was a quote-unquote cookout at a private home on the front beach in East Hampton. And there were so many things I learned, among which was on the bus ride going out, I was like, whose house are we going to? Do you know who's the host? And the executive chef was like, I don't know. That's not important. What's important is the client, who's the party planner, right? That's the job. That's who gives you the job. The host doesn't matter. But I was like, I'm going to reverse Google this. Like, we have the home address. And it was like, it was the head of a huge media corporation. That man had made $50 million that year, or the previous year, $54 million. So, like, for him to spend $1 million on a cookout, that's probably a business expense anyway.
A cookout where no Oprah was going to be there, and Martha Stewart, and Nancy Pelosi, and, like, you know, I mean,
that's money well spent. The talent for these 120 adults and 40 children was Diana Ross. So that gives you a sense of, like, you know, that's who was performing.
Not our normal Sundays.
There was a Gucci fireworks show. There was a Cake Boss cake. There was a whole team
doing sand sculpture on the beach.
There was a team of security. There's a team of babysitters. There's a team, you know, there's the green room. That's a whole separate menu, is the green room for, you know, Diana Ross and her people. You know, it's
security has its own menu.
It's, you know, there was an event director at the Met Museum, who said, you know, she would have, you know, basically an event every day. But for the major events, she would say, I was basically building a house in 3 days with a budget of, you know, $800,000, $1 million, and then tearing it down in 24 hours. And that's the kind of thing. I mean, at that upper level, it's really excessive.
It's not that dissimilar from a food festival. Like, when you think about the
true
kind of, like,
true,
this is a much larger scale.
But who's it for? But, you know, the difference is, like,
yeah.
The scale of guests here at the festival is much greater. And so you could argue that the impact in educational value and
is broader.
Right. It's benefiting thousands of people.
For 120 adults and 40 kids, it's like, you know, it's pretty insular.
So we did a lot of different chapters because we were truly fascinated more from, like, a sociological and historical angle on this. How did we get to this place where you're doing these ridiculous extravagances? And so we did a deep dive on the history of catering, which at least this modern era begins back in the late 60s, early 70s, we discovered, with some a few enterprising, very creative individuals, mostly in New York City, who just freed events from the stranglehold that banquet halls had on them, like hotel banquet halls and club banquet halls in New York City.
Private clubs.
And, you know, church parish halls and stuff. Like, that's where you had a wedding. And suddenly these guys were like, and they were mostly guys, were like, no, let's do this in the Temple of Dendur. It's fabulous. Like, you got to see this. You know, the lighting is incredible. And if only we can figure out the food aspect of it, because there are no kitchens in museums for the most part. And they hacked the hot box. They loaded it with Sterno, and the rest
by
is history.
By hot box, he means transport cabinet.
Yeah, it was a transport cabinet just for moving food around on sheet pans, and they figured out that they could certainly move the food to the venue in that cabinet, but then they can empty it and turn it into an oven, a really pretty commendable oven.
Warming oven, not a roasting oven.
Right, but so we have a whole chapter on allergies and how that's transformed catering. There's a whole chapter on food design, because that's a fascinating aspect of, like, you know, if you've got the constraints you've got, what can you do? And how do you move the ball forward every year? If it's an annual gala, for example, you can't serve the same food, right, as last
it
year.
Always
and you have to make it more fabulous than last
and
year.
And better. So. And there are caterers who specialize in that, where every piece of food is an interaction. You know, it's like an aha moment. It's the kind of food designed for Instagram.
The one chapter we didn't do that we should have done is the waste chapter.
Yeah.
Because as I'm sure if you're listening and thinking about these giant productions, like, there's a ton of waste that goes on, and you know, whether you can abide that as a chef, like as a, you know, professional, like, kind of have to if you don't want to, like, you know, self-destruct.
Another aspect that I'm curious about in terms of just changing over time, over the decades, is people internally, how they viewed working for a catering company, and now if it's changed from the perspective of it being a cool job or an acceptable job. From my perspective, I see people that get into catering now because it provides you a certain lifestyle that maybe a restaurant can't provide. The money's actually can be quite good, right? So
yeah.
Did you talk to anyone that maybe had a deep restaurant pedigree and bailed on that lifestyle to get into catering?
Yeah, there were a lot of...
We drilled down on precisely those people who had made the jump from catering to restaurants or vice versa, and we talked to Danny Meyer. You know, he's someone who sort of symbolizes, you know, what restaurant culture can be at its ideal and has written about it, and yet he got into catering and for a time got his ass handed to him. And he spoke very poignantly and sort of depressingly about... The
learning curve.
Well, but just how, like, catering will never be what it is in restaurant world, where you build your house and your culture there, and you have that luxury of, like, digging in and presenting yourself to the world in this, like, settled way, and you know who your employees are. He said, you know, you show up on site at a catering event at 4 p.m. and no one knows where they are. And no one knows who the other employees are. And so there's always these
hollowness
disconnects.
He described.
And he said it was hollow.
But you asked about the restaurant catering move, and we did encounter a lot of chefs who left restaurants to get a more normal schedule, because there's not really anything normal about doing galas for 1,400 people, but there is, like...
In the prep kitchen.
In the prep kitchen, it's more a schedule. You can be an executive chef and make more money because there's no glory in it. There's no... fame, but, you know, and have a bit more of a regimen, you know. There's not that sort of craziness of a restaurant. But I, you know, there's still a long ways to go. I talked to the director of a big cooking school in New York and said, you know, how are you? They had a brand new facility that I was touring. I was like, are you encouraging people to work in catering and viewing that as an option? And he was like, oh. No, I wouldn't ever consider it. I would never consider it. You don't understand. Like, our graduates are going to Union Square Cafe. They're going to Per Se. They're going to out to the French Laundry. And, it was interesting to me to just hear the director of a cooking school, you know, discouraging.
Still has a negative connotation as a career path.
Still has a hugely negative connotation as a career path when it's actually really, there's a lot of excitement and glory and thrill. And if you're the kind of person who can hack it.
It also makes me think of, on the same way with catering, that it would be also interesting to see if, like, school cafeteria jobs, or, you know, working at, like, retirement facilities, like, cook, because those are places where it's not considered, like, chefing. right? And it's those more, are places where we need to.
It's considered
good food.
Industrial, but we still need to have people in those places that are great. And it was interesting because at this event last year, I met a woman who was a pastry chef for restaurants all around downtown, and now she's out at Bishop Gadsden, which is a nursing home around here. And I was like, "How is that?" And she's like, "It's awesome. I love it. I love my customers. You know, I love. It's just it's a different style for sure, but."
It may be a better balance
it may
for
be a
their
better
life too.
Work-life balance yeah. for them.
You know? There are these unacknowledged class distinctions in food that no one wants to talk about, and we certainly encountered one in catering. But you're right; they exist, you know, throughout the kitchen space. And it's like, why is cooking in one situation less worthy than another?
Because we're not always eating in restaurants.
You know, I guess we hold this ideal of that. Of the chef as this Zeus-like, you know, inventor of like high design and stuff, and if the setting like a nursing home doesn't meet that, you know, if they're having to sacrifice their high design to volume or you know chewability or something, then that like eliminates that person from contention for a James Beard Award, like. You know, we have to examine why that is and you know, who's driving that in this era.
I'm curious to hear your insight also on, like, the way that guests interact with catering staff, like, whether it's cooks or servers. Like, so both of my parents were caterers in the 90s in New York and did, like, very high-end.
Oh, my God, we should have interviewed you.
No, oh, God. But it's so interesting because, like, some of my mom's best stories are, like, she would do private parties, like, for the Whitneys and going unacknowledged, but then all of a sudden, like, Bill Murray would be in the kitchen and like only want to talk to them while they're prepping yeah. for dinner. You know what I mean? But so like,
well, that's specific to Bill Murray.
That's probably exactly. But it's like, you know, in restaurants, I think like people, most people who have any sort of manners have a rapport with the staff. In catering, it's like you don't exist.
Yeah. And that was, you know, and that was for the few times that we were guest facing, because we would never be guest facing as a kitchen assistant. Unless there was like a at that cookout, there would be stations and things like that. But yeah, you don't get seen. Like, and one of my first panics at that East Hampton Beach party was that Martha Stewart was there, and we were her wine columnist for 5 years. And I was like, oh damn! Like this is
I'm here. He is slinging hot dogs.
I'm gonna be busted.
Well,
here I am, like faking flipping burgers because there was sort of like a smoke and mirrors element
yeah.
to it. Because every burger was coming out of a hot box. You're not seen. And it was a little bit...
She didn't see you.
She didn't see me.
Did she take you aside and say,
no.
Do you need some gigs? Do you?
Is everything you okay?
You can write for me again if you want.
She didn't see me. But
no, he was invisible because he was shoulder to shoulder with other kitchen drones. So mm-hmm. he did not exist. You know?
And there was this weird thing where it kind of like bugged me at first. But then I was like, no, this is the authority of the uniform. It's like... I'm being treated as a professional.
Yeah.
That's
you can
my
walk
role.
Into any Fort Knox in New York City dressed as a caterer
yeah.
and not have to show credentials.
Here for the event.
Because, you're obviously there for the event.
Specifically as a KA with the little beanie
yeah.
and
you
know, ill-fitting polyester chef's jacket, you know, really... smeared black generic shoes,
you know,
not clogs necessarily, although those would reinforce the idea, but just like, you know, sensible shoes and then like, you know, stained black pants.
Now that you have gone kind of undercover in this facet of the food industry, are you interested in kind of taking this framework and applying it to any other aspects of the culinary universe? Or do you maybe want to expand still on catering and that? What's the next...
Well,
maybe
so,
book or plan.
On the immediate horizon, we've partnered with a production company to begin processing and trying to develop something of a documentary series that could be shopped around at some point, just because we want it to go out to a wider audience. You know, books are great, but you know, a lot of people are using that
to go to
thing.
A wider audience and also have the characters who live this life have them tell their stories, you know, so it's not just me and Matt filtering their stories. It's like actually
and showing it,
it's
you know,
primary
in front of the camera. So that's one thing. And what else are we working on? But yeah, so the method, it took us 6 years to write the book because we didn't, even though we'd written for magazines and newspapers and had published cookbooks, like, those are short bites, short takes for the most part. And so writing long form stuff and trying to braid together his experience, my experience as brothers, but on different scenes and different settings was complicated. And it took us like an extra 3 or 4 years just to figure out how to write. And with the help of some great editors, and we even brought in some freelancer friends to help advise us, I think we kind of cracked it. Hopefully it was readable, right?
It was such a page-turner, yeah.
But we've never done that kind of long-form writing before, so it definitely felt new to us. But
to answer your question, I think we are going to bring that framework to another part of the food industry, but we just haven't figured out where.
School cafeterias, maybe.
Yeah, cafeterias.
Cruise ships.
Cruise ships.
Well, don't stop right now. Yeah. Not right now. Let's wait till.
Yeah.
We won't get quarantined on.
One top caterer in New York, Neil Gallagher, came from Restaurant World. We were interested in him because he's one of those few who came from Restaurant World, went to catering and killed in catering and innovated and brought to it some, just one thing was containerizing the side dish per plate in a disposable foil cup. And so the baby fingerlings or whatever would all be containerized back in the prep kitchen. And so on site, you could bring in a waiter and just dump that cup on the plate, and it was consistent in volume. Because previously they had just delivered serving spoons, and people would be serving out of a vat or something.
Yeah.
And so it'd be irregular. And he brought that kind of like scientific consistency.
Anyhow.
And a lot of waste, aluminum waste. But
the point is he went on from there to be the like culinary director.
He's now the culinary director.
Royal Caribbean.
Royal Caribbean, yeah. Living down in Florida and managing like 16 restaurants around the world, you know, because they float.
No. So you can be in catering and have
yes.
amazing, and massive success
yes.
on kind of a grand scale.
Yep. Totally.
And bringing it back to the food festival, you actually see there's all these dinners and events going on at night, these plated, ticketed events where chefs are actually very much out of their comfort zone
for
and being
sure.
thrown Absolutely. Up against the world of catering. Like we went to a dinner the other night where three chefs who obviously have their own restaurants and their own staff were in a tent pouring rain.
Right.
They meet the servers and their sous chefs 11 minutes before the dinner starts. And then you have to trust people to plate out your food, right? But
right.
a caterer is used to that.
Yeah.
Because you were talking about
yeah.
mercenaries.
Right.
They're expecting new bodies to come in all the time.
Exactly.
But it was really fascinating to hear the chefs after the dinner we were speaking with them. They are not comfortable with that
they're
type
not,
of environment.
They're super
it is,
not down.
It is the exact opposite of what an intuitive restaurant experience is like.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
so...
It's so cool, the new era with festivals, with pop-ups and everything. Restaurant chefs and young chefs coming up in the business are being pushed more into that sort of, you know, liminal space where you kind of have to make food happen wherever you find yourself to be. And it might be an unfamiliar city. It might be out in the clover. It might be, you never know.
And, on the beach.
And being improvisational in that way, logistically, like, oh, we don't have... the Sterno shipment didn't come in. Well, is there some firewood? Can we turn these benches into firewood? You know,
yeah.
Is this alcohol, burnable? Like, you just start improvising. Yeah.
And,
you have
and
no choice.
You learn that you definitely want to roll with a crew that who's used to that and comfortable with that and wants, sort of loves the challenge of that, of making the best out of what the circumstances are right now. You know?
Yeah. Well, we have to wrap up, but I do want to mention that there is a pop-up bookstore here at Charleston Wine and Food, so anyone who wants to go grab Hot Box, I believe I saw it over there.
Right on, yeah. Blue Bicycles, yeah. rocking the bookstore
and
in Marion
obviously
Square.
Find it at independent booksellers, Amazon if you must, but...
Everywhere.
Everywhere. All right. Thanks, Matt and Ted.
Paperback
Thank
coming
you all
out
so
in
much.
April.
Oh.
That's
exciting.
Yeah.
Another scoop.
Yes.
What I do.
That is a scoop. Totally.
I get the scoop out of the Lee brother.
Break all the Lee.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you
for having Heritage Radio Network.
We appreciate it.
And thanks to the Julia Child Foundation for supporting our coverage of Charleston Wine and Food. We'll be right back with Krista Cotton of El Guapo Bitters.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.